following presentation was recorded live by Voices from Jerusalem.
I've got to assume something about the title. That you mean, can a reasonable person believe in what happened at Mount Sinai while using his reason? Because reasonable people believe anything. There is literally nothing that intelligent, reasonable people have not bought. Which is not an inconsiderable problem. Obviously, reason is subject to wanting as well. I mean, it is not a pure act. Evidently, will has something to do with reason. There are intelligent people, by the way. If we are to deal with this topic, you're going to have to forgive me if I'm blunt and speak truth. I know that it is not courteous or fashionable or acceptable to say about other people that what they believe is nonsense. But how are we going to deal with reason unless we also identify that which is nonsense? And therefore, it would be necessary, if we ought to talk intelligently at all, to make the statement very bluntly that all religions, except for the Jewish religion, is clearly, obviously, definitely nonsense. And that no intelligent, reasonable person who is using his reason and hasn't either decided that he wants to believe or has made a leap of faith cannot be a Christian, a Muslim, a Buddhist, etc. No way. Certainly not any revealed religion. Because, and I'll tell you a little story, a joke, that goes back a couple of hundred years in among Jews. The joke goes as follows. A Hasidic rabbi, Rebbe, died without leaving instructions as to which of his two surviving sons he wanted the community, the Hasidic community, to place as his heir. And there developed a dispute with those who favored the older son and those who favored the younger son, and it was an unhappy situation. And one day, one of the two sons comes and calls together the elders of the congregation, and he says to them, "Last night in my sleep, my father appeared to me in a dream, and he said to me, 'I want you to call together the elders of the congregation and to say to them in my name, it is my wish and my direction that they appoint you as my successor.'" Everybody's silent and oppressed, and one man gets up and he says, "You know," he says, "your father wanted us to appoint you as his successor. He should have come to us in our dream, not to you in yours. If God wanted Muhammad to be his prophet, he had to come to the people and say, 'Muhammad is my prophet.' He can't talk to Muhammad and go say, 'Go ahead, Muhammad, tell them you're my prophet.' How do you believe him? What reasonable human being can buy it? Why? There are liars, there are well-meaning deceivers, there are scoundrels, there are visionaries. Why do you believe any person who comes to you and says to you, 'God spoke to me and said that you should believe that I am a prophet'? It is inherently, obviously nonsense. And no reasonable human being who wants to follow reason and has not made a leap of faith, a decision to accept, cannot possibly believe when a human being comes and says, 'I am a prophet.'" This is true of all of them. Paul, Jesus never said it. Paul, who had a vision on the way to Damascus, in which God appears and tells him that Jesus is really the Son of God, and the Torah is fulfilled, something that none of the followers of Jesus had ever heard about before, and people take it seriously. It's not reasonable. It's because they want, they desire, they need, it fulfills something. They're looking for it. They want their hearts to accept the Lamb. They've made a leap of faith. There was a time and it wasn't very long ago, that the Christians proclaimed the truth of their faith by proving it from the Jewish Bible. They no longer can. It's not tenable any longer. And therefore they now go to the leap of faith route. Or they have other arguments. These people didn't believe it. Would they have given their lives? They obviously believe it. Sure they believe it. People believe anything. The people who claim they saw it, are they telling the truth? They gave their life for it. If they did, you don't know that people give their lives for lies once they put their reputation on the line. People will die for a lie that they proclaimed and that gave them position and strength and power and prestige. They'll die for it. You know that for a fact. And the Muslims, the beauty of the Quran. You know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Quran isn't one of the most successfully translated books that the world had. It isn't one of the most widely read. The Bible is. Or if God didn't really speak to Muhammad, would he have let him have such a series of victories? Well, he did the Christians, and are both true. And so there is no way that a reasonable person who is using his reason and subjecting his beliefs to the scrutiny of reason can possibly accept any faith. The only one that we can discuss, the only one that we can talk about in a reasonable way is the Jewish faith. Because you see, the Jewish faith claims that God didn't say to Moses, go and speak to the people of Israel and tell them that you are my prophet. The Jewish faith claims that God spoke to the people and said to the people, Moses is my prophet. Believe it. That's the difference. It is enough of a difference that makes it open to discussion. Reasonable people can now talk. Shall we believe this happened? Because at the least the claim is one that a reasonable person has to deal with. The claim isn't believe Moses. That's nonsense. The claim isn't believe the rabbis. That's foolish. The claim is believe God. Because God said that Moses is my prophet. Now you're going to have to deal with this uniqueness in itself. It's something that intellectually you have to deal with. Why? Why of all the thousands and literally thousands of religions which we have recorded, has there never been any that made a claim that a reasonable person can deal with? No religion has ever built itself on a claim other than the one, believe me, my heart is pure, I do not lie to you, believe me when I tell you that the angel Moroni came and gave me the books of Mormon. Can a reasonable person believe that John Smith's claim is one that we should use to build our lives on? The man comes with a story that he was walking and an angel comes and gives him the book, and the books of Mormon, of course, happened to be lost after he saw it and read it. Worldwide religion, the Mormons are a very successful religion. Is it serious or the Christian Science? Is it serious? Something to deal with, to talk about? Mary Baker Eddy stands on a hill and God talks to her. Why? None, none ever in the whole history of mankind has made the claim, God told us, all of us, the people, the nation, all of us, that this man is his prophet. None have made the claim that he came to us in our dreams and said to us, I want you to make him my successor. Oh, they came to the one in wanted the results. He's the one who got the dream. He's the one who got the message. Believe me, I am God's prophet. He had to persuade and sway and hit the right emotional buttons. Parents don't lie to their children. They don't. A Christian father doesn't say to his son and a Christian mother to her daughter, I saw Jesus. They say that your great-grandfather was a barbarian who worshipped stones and wood idols. And there came a man in a ship, and this man brought them a message of the happy tidings of the coming of the Christ. And your grandfather believed him. That's why we believe him. They don't tell a different story. The Mohammedans don't tell their children other than the truth. Mohammed came and he claimed that God spoke to him and they didn't believe him and they did. And he slaughtered all those who didn't accept him. And therefore we do accept him. That's what they tell. They don't tell it any different. No people make a claim to their children other than the one they accept as actual. You've got to believe because we were persuaded. Father, mother, why should I believe that grandfather's decision was a good one? Because he was persuaded that I should direct my life and build it. On that kind of a base, does it make sense? But it makes good sense. I will have a nice social life, comfortable, at ease, security, heaven on a platter. It's delightful. I am offered the world to come and the world that is on a platter. There's very little I have to do for it. It's a delight. Why should I reject it? Comes the Jew and he tells a different story altogether. He says, we were there. We, all of us, were there. And we heard God speak. And what he said to us was that Moses is his prophet. A unique event in the history of mankind. Do you know of another? I do. The Greeks. The Greeks were a unique people in the history of mankind. The burst of creative energy of the Greek nation has never been duplicated. It is a unique event in the history of mankind. It is. But one that the Torah deals with, Yefeifei Yusei Shel Yefes B'Yohalei Sheva. But other than that, what unique event do you know of? What unique story have you ever heard or read of? Is there a fairy tale that you've seen that isn't duplicated dozens of times all over the world? The Eskimos and the Mexicans and the Congolese all tell the same general fairy tale. They represent human experiences. And because human experiences are so similar, they tell similar stories. Values are similar. There's only one unique story that mankind tells, and that is that God spoke to all the people. I want to know, don't we have to deal with that uniqueness? Don't we have to find some explanation? Why, of all the peoples of the world and all the stories that the world has told in their tens of thousands, had there never been another duplicate of this unique claim that God spoke to the people of Israel and said to them, Moses is my prophet, believe him when he speaks in my name. Something that any honest person, any person seeking the truth, wherever it may lead, is going to have to deal with. You have to confront it. If it's a lie, why didn't anybody else say and claim such a gorgeous lie? It helps. It's advantageous. Why not make it up? It is difficult, really difficult, to make any assumption other than the one that it is a story you cannot tell unless it's true. Because in the very telling of the story, you are proclaiming yourself a liar if it isn't true. Whom are you talking to when you said God spoke to all of us? Not to many, not to thousands, but to all of us. Then why didn't my father tell me about it? Well, your father was, you just said all of us. Why wasn't the neighbor down the street know about it? Well, you said all of us. Are you reneging? Are you pulling back? You're a liar. How do you tell this story if it isn't true? And never mind, you'll answer me, you can. Fine. But why didn't they? If it can be made up, if you can proclaim this falsehood, without it being true, why didn't somebody else make it up? Why was it made up once, and once only, in the whole history of mankind, and the only story that was made up once, and once only, in the whole history of mankind? Now, reasonable. It is unreasonable to believe that these people made it up and got away with it, and nobody else was able to even try. It's unreasonable. Reasonable people can't make such a claim. Or so, you make a different claim. Maybe. And that itself is a fantastic thing. The Christian has to say, well, maybe it happened. The Muslim has to say, maybe it happened. The Jew has to say, well, maybe such and such happened to explain it away. Do you hear the difference? It is unbelievable, this difference. All other religions have to explain why you should believe it. The Jew has to explain why you shouldn't believe it. Well, even though it is such a story, but maybe a starship came from a star far, far away, and gave it through loudspeakers on the mountain, and the people thought it was God speaking to them. I've seen this suggestion. It's printed. Maybe. You got to come up with a lot of maybes to explain it away. Every other religion, you have to explain why you should make it. And this one, you have to explain why not. There's something there that needs a lot of explanation. But then you got to give me another one. There is a Bible. It was written by someone, for sure. It's there. It was written by God. Well, let's say no. The alternative, I assume, must be that a man wrote. A human being wrote. We've got two alternatives now. God wrote it. Human being wrote. Okay, let's take human being wrote. Which human being? Not a Jew. No way. Do you believe a Jew wrote that his ancestors were liars? That his ancestors kidnapped a brother and sold him into slavery? That these people preferred slavery to freedom? Or that Jacob was a thief and a liar? They wrote it about their ancestors. Why? Why would they write it? No other people have ever written unfavorable reports about their ancestors. Never happened. You can't read about a single defeat of the Egyptians in Egyptian history. If you want something bad about the Egyptians, you got to read Assyrian history. And if you want to find out something uncomplimentary about the Assyrians, you got to read Babylonian history. There is no way that you're going to find that even today, with our modern scientific historians, it is amazing the difference between an American historian And a Canadian historian, when you come to tell the story of the Revolutionary War, that's with modern scientific research-based history. But the olden times, there is no such thing as writing something unpleasant, uncomplimentary about my people. But the funny thing about the Jewish Bible is, not that it has unpleasant things, but it doesn't have any nice things. There is nothing that they have to say about the Jewish people that is nice. Nothing. From the beginning to the end, it's a series of disasters. Who wrote it? It's got to be an anti-Semite, a deep anti-Semite who persuaded the Jews to accept it. And of all the people to persuade to accept it, these are people who buy things easily. The Samki Shayorif, who when they see it with their own eyes don't want to believe it. Then they believe this anti, this Hitler who came and told them all about their horrible history and they believed it. One would find it difficult to assume that it is anything but the truth. The only way that book could have been written is if it's the truth. There is no way that a man made it up. Therefore, it's all true except for one little thing, except for God. That part they made up. All the rest has got to be true. There's no way it could have been written. But even if it were true, what Jew would bother writing and at least not throw in a little mitigating circumstance? Now listen, we do throw in mitigating circumstances. We explain it all away, but not in the book. The book is stark and straight. We don't want to live with it, and so we explain, well, it doesn't really mean this. So we said it doesn't really mean that. You know, I remember reading when, what's his name, the teaching bishop, he had a show on television, Fulton Sheen. Fulton Sheen became the bishop of Rochester, Rochester or Buffalo? Rochester. And he was invited to a ecumenical meeting in a Reformed temple in Buffalo. He spoke, and I read the printed report in the newspaper of his talk. He gave the sermon at the temple, and the sermon was as follows. Do not despair. Never give up hope. If Jacob could make it, anybody can. A liar, a thief, a robbed, fooled his brother, his father-in-law. If Jacob could make it, anybody can. It means God is open to anyone. And he's right. All you have to do is read that Bible. And he read it. And that's his picture of Jacob. And I'll show you many a sermon by many a rabbi, apologetic, red-faced, doing something and presenting our patriarchs. It's really very embarrassing. So we explain it away, fine. But who wrote it? Who wrote this book? It's hard to escape that a God wrote it and gave it to us. And we had to accept it whether we would or not. Whether we liked it or not, and we didn't like it, and we'll delay, and we'll twist, and we'll squirm, because we don't want to have to live with it, but we have to live with it, and we don't want to live with it, but we have to live with it, and there's no way out. What other explanation can a reasonable human being give? But there is another question that you really have to face when you start dealing with it. What religion makes demands of its adherents without guarantees? Believe and thou shalt be saved. Believe and your place in heaven is assured. That's the least that you offer your follower. What can you do less than that? That's what you buy him with. You may not have this life, but you'll have eternal life. You'll have the life to come. You're saved. You'll go to heaven. And we can guarantee you heaven. And come the Jew and they give you a body of laws, a body of what they say is the truth. And they say, well, we offer you a lifetime of travail, a lifetime of effort, and hopefully, hopefully, you'll make it to heaven. If you direct yourself well, if you make proper judgments, if you make good decisions, you use your mind, you use your body, you use above all your God-given free will. If you do all these, you'll go to heaven. If you do all these, believing isn't going to make it for you. No, sorry, it's not enough. You got to work a lifetime. Will you give me peace of mind, Rabbi? No, I can't give you peace of mind. I can only give you work to do. Rabbi, are you crazy? Why should I do it? I don't know why you should do it unless it's because it's the truth. Who offers that to their customers? When you're making up a religion, is this the kind of religion you make up? Is this what you do? You're selling things? You sell this? This is a salesman? Paul is a salesman. Paul, gorgeous. Listen to what the man did. It's beautiful. The supreme, superb salesman of all time. Listen, my friends. You know that the Jews taught us, and it was the Jews who taught the empire, that idol worship is no longer acceptable. We can't do that anymore. God is transcendent. God is not man. God is not in the body. He's not limited. He's an infinite spirit. Sure, we all know that. But you're having trouble with that, aren't you? You're having trouble with a transcendent God. How to relate to him? You can't see him. You can't talk to him. How do you pray to him? You're having trouble. Okay, listen. I'm going to give you this God. Here he is, transcendent. No limitations. Infinite. No body. But he's also a man hanging on the wall. So you can look at him and pray to him and hug him and carry him around in your pocket. He's transcendent. No limits. One. But he's also three. So that you can relate to whatever part you like. And then, you know, did you ever hear of a believing Christian who prayed to God? They don't pray to God. You can't relate to God. You pray to Yashka, you pray to Jesus, to the man. You know something? It's hard to pray to the man. He's not an attractive figure hanging there on the cross with veils in his hands and his feet. No, no, you pray to his mother. A mother is a delightful figure, warm and good-hearted. You can relate to a mother well. Who do they pray to? Hail Mother, Mary, Mother of God. Can you get a better salesmanship than that? You've got it made. You have a God who intellectually you can accept, but at the same time, I can appeal to your emotions. You can relate to the God. It's a gorgeous piece of salesmanship. But that wasn't all. You know the God, he told you this man, when he was alive, really God, looked like a man, really God. What he said to you was that you have to carry out the Torah. The Torah is an awful burden. You don't need to anymore. It's fulfilled. You're free. Just believe. Tell me, is it a gorgeous salesmanship or is it? Have you got it made? And the Jew comes and he says, you got to pray to a God whom you can't see. And the people need something to represent. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. There's nothing that represents. You got to use your mind as well as your heart. And you got to relate to a abstract God. And you've got to do that. And that is so hard. It's a killer. But that's what you gotta do. That's what you gotta do. You gotta pray to a God whom you can't touch, whom you can't see, whom you can't feel, whom you can't represent. You gotta love him. And you gotta revere him. And you gotta relate to him and recognize him and deal with him. Nobody else makes that demand. Better yet, everybody knows the first mark of a religion, step number one of any religion, is don't think. Don't read. Don't you bother getting information. You need information, go to the priest. He'll give you whatever you need. And you know what they said to the priest? Don't read too much. Read just, you know, if you have deeper things, go to the bishop. He'll tell you. Because knowledge is a dangerous thing. But worse than that, what do you need it for? What do you need knowledge for? It can only hurt. And the Jew, the first and foremost obligation is to study, to know, because you got to make decisions. Nobody's going to tell you what to do. You've got to figure out the right thing. You've got to make decisions. You've got to be responsible. How can you do that unless you study, unless you know, unless you think, unless you're aware? Do you know of any other religion that not only allows but demands study and learning as the foremost religious obligation? Tell me something. Is it a pure coincidence that we're unique in all these peculiar ways and you can't find such a uniqueness anywhere else? Is it pure coincidence? Can it really be just by some crazy accident that the Jews claim that God spoke to all of them in a way that you can't lie about, that Moses is a true prophet? He gives them a chumash which shakes them up and makes them believe, and they have to take the humility of believing all that it tells. Makes demands on them of extraordinary power, promises them nothing other than opportunities. No guarantees, no certainties, opportunities. And then tells them to learn, study, think. And none of these things, none of them, to be duplicated elsewhere. Doesn't it require some sort of explanation? Is it really all pure coincidence? Well, let's go a little bit further. Let's take one more step. Do you honestly believe? And you're going to show me, sure, but honestly believe. Don't answer. Think to yourself. That a human being will write a law that is inherently impossible to accept, impossible to keep. Like, for instance, every seventh year, proceed to take you and your family and starve to death. Not one-seventh of your land every year, but every seventh year, no working on the land at all. No plowing, no sowing, no harvesting. Just sit home and study and learn. Every seventh year. And every 50th, 2 years in a row, mind you, the 49th year and the 50th year, 2 years in a row, no planting, no growing. I don't know who's going to be alive by the 50th year. Don't do it. Why do you say such a thing? Why? Why would a man make such a ridiculous law? But then he goes a step further. Listen to what this man says to them. It's going to bother you, huh? You know, seventh year, you don't plant, you don't grow. I got children. God, what do you want from me? It's okay, I'll tell you what I'll do. The year in advance, I'll give you a double crop. In advance, I'll give you a double crop. So you don't have to worry. You'll have enough in advance to carry you through the year of not planting. In advance, you got enough. Who talks like that? How does a human being say that? He's guaranteeing a double crop a year in advance to a whole people. That's not the first time it happens. They'll see you're a liar. Why would he do such a thing? Does it make sense? Is there such a law anywhere among mankind? A law inherently impossible that will expose itself as being absurd at the very first attempt to keep it? Does that make sense? Where did you find such a place anywhere in the history of mankind? And how could you? How could there be such a law? You want another example? I'll give you another one. 3 times a year, every year, all of you, all, every one of you, come up to Jerusalem to visit the Holy Temple. Not to Jerusalem, Mokim Hashem, the place that I will designate, which turned out to be Jerusalem. 3 times a year, come there. Well, wait a minute. God, you know, the Moabites are waiting over there to wipe me out. The Ammonites are waiting down there to wipe me out. Philistines, the Palestinians are waiting down there to wipe me out. God, how can I leave it and come up with? Don't worry, I'll take care of it for you. While you're in Jerusalem visiting me, I'll see to it that nothing happens to your land or your crops or your animals or your home. Leave it to me. I'll take care of it for you. Who talks like that? I can hear God talking like that. Can you hear a human being saying that? What do you expect him to come a second time? What do you expect? That they won't come in from all they need is an empty without the people there to protect it, and they won't wipe them out? Who's talking? Who's giving? And who wants to give his own people such a law to give the enemies who are waiting to destroy them every advantage, to feed it to them? Here it is. Why would you do it? Who's talking? A man? A human being? Wrote that law? Can a reasonable person accept that a human being wrote that law, even if he's insane? Insanity has reason to. A man who thinks he's Napoleon is logical in the consequences, and he acts like a Napoleon, and he deals like a Napoleon. Which insane person wrote these laws? But if God wrote them, it makes sense. You know, he can. You know, he could. He really could. He can guarantee that nothing is going to happen while you're away. But who else is going to guarantee it? Who makes these rules? Then again, another coincidence. Another coincidence to the uniqueness. Tell me, there are a lot of books written by a lot of people. Prophecies of the future, every one of them a joke. But that book has prophecies. It describes in horrid detail what will overtake the people of Israel when they leave God. And it's happened in all its details, in all its vivid, incredible details. And he said, you'll come back. And he said, you'll be thrown out again. And he said, and much later, you'll come back again. Self-fulfilling prophecies? Come on. A self-fulfilling prophecy after 2,000 years? Can you picture a self-fulfilling prophecy that for 2,000 years couldn't fulfill itself and all of a sudden it died? You know, people who didn't give up after 100 years, 200, 300 years, they didn't give up. A self-fulfilling prophecy for people who had a God, and had a faith in an actual God. And it happened 2,000 years later. 2,000 years they knew and waited for it to come about and come to that. But doesn't this come about straight, mind you? There is within our tradition that the nations of the world will have to okay it. At the same time, they hate us. They don't want to okay. So what happened? So the Russians had an aberration, and the Russians and the Americans, and if you read anything about that vote in the United Nations, you know the incredible concatenation of events that brought about that. The Russians and the Americans, in spite of everybody fighting against it, finally decided to vote for partition and that Israel should be officially established. And the next day, try to get out of it. The next day. And then making sure that the Jews and the land should be defeated. Oh, in the name of, obviously, the name of neutrality. The name of neutrality, they would send no arms to an unarmed people while the Arabs surrounding them were heavily armed and heavily with the latest of weapons, outnumbered them 100-1. They're standing neutral. Lovely, peace-loving people. They fell in, they couldn't help themselves, they voted. And then wished that they hadn't tried to get out of it, and it was gone, it was too late. And they're stuck with the land of Israel and the state of Israel. They're stuck with it. And they're suffering ever since and wishing that it had never happened. But it did. But we knew it for 2,000 years that it would be that way. Do you know another case? Do you know another situation? Or maybe a people who survived without a language, without a land, without a common culture, 2,000 years. Do you know another case? And were told in advance that that's what would happen. We're told how they would be dispersed in that Kunish, though it's written 3,000 years ago. It's written right there. They would be dispersed to all the corners of the earth. What other nation was dispersed to all the corners of the earth and retained your identity? Did it ever happen? Did it happen? Who writes such things? Such utter nonsense. Such utter impossibility. So I say to you as follows. How do we explain that reasonable people, people who are intelligent, people who are reasonable, face this array of facts and doubt that God spoke to the people of Israel at Mount Sinai? How do you explain it? How can a reasonable person possibly doubt this straightforward story given over through the ages, generation after generation, without a flaw, without a break? A straightforward story without complications. God came and told us Moses is his prophet. No other people tell lies. Why would we? No other people make it up. Why do we? Explain it away. Why explain it away? Why? Why isn't it true? Why is it that intelligent, reasonable people are prepared to doubt so clear, so sharp a story, backed by such enormous weight of evidence? The kind of an evidence that you would risk your life on without a moment's hesitation if it wasn't in terms of religion. Why? Why all of a sudden do we have conditions of proof so rigorous when it comes to accepting the reality of God speaking to us that you do not apply to any other question that comes up in your daily life? Why? And the answer's got to be because you don't like the consequences. I had once a fantastic story happen to me. In the city of Baltimore, there was at one time, this goes back over, a good 25 years, they had a group of Jewish psychiatrists. And at that time, it was still true, they were all male. A group of Jewish psychiatrists who formed a kind of social club together where they would get together, the men and their wives, in the homes of a different member of this group every month. And the host was responsible for providing a program, a speaker of interest, or some kind of a cultural program. And this particular host was the host for this month. I came down and I started speaking. I'm about 15 minutes into it when one of them gets up and says, "Rabbi, I want you to stop talking. There is no way that I can describe to you the sense of shock. It's just not done." I was shocked. He says, "Rabbi, if you keep talking, I'm going to have to change the way I live. And I like the way I live." They all said, no, Rabbi, go talk. And I did the foolish thing. I started talking again. He got up, walked to the front closet, got his coat, and left. His wife was left there. He went away without it. He was not one to listen. And after I finished, I went over to her and asked her her name. She refused to give it. I asked the host if he would tell me the name, and he refused. I never was able to find out who he was. I would have loved to speak to him. But the fact is, he's one of the few who is straightforward and honest enough to say, "I don't want to hear it. It's going to upset my way of living." The rest of us managed to listen and somehow or other let it slide out without bothering to digest it in between. Of course, it means that I've got to change my way of living. If God is, if this is real, can I do less than learn it, than study it, than consider the implications for my own life, for my own future, for my own present, for my own existence, for my children? It's earth-shattering. It means that everything I believe has to be re-examined. Everything I do has to be reassessed. It's earth-shattering. How much easier to say, "Well, there must have been something. Well, maybe. Well, That's the answer. It's the answer you're going to give me right away. You're going to give me, well... What's he going to say? Maybe, people could... he wants prestige and he'll make stupid laws. You don't believe somebody makes up such a stupid law. But you'll say it. You'll say it and persuade yourself. And it's not amazing. It's not amazing at all. You know, the Russians will tell us how they are peace-loving and we are the warmongering. And we read it, and you know something? We start thinking, maybe. And the imperialistic Israelis, expansionist-minded, is there anyone, seriously, anyone in the world who doesn't know that if the Arabs don't attack them, there is not one Arab who will be hurt? There is not one inch of land that will be annexed? Is there anyone who doubts that if they didn't attack the Israelis, there never would have been any attempt made to take one inch of the land given to the Arabs? Anybody who doubts it? But they're the expansionists. You can talk anything. When you don't want, if you don't want to believe, you persuade yourself anything. We can take white and scream to everybody, "Look at that black piece of board." And everybody looks at the white board and they say, "Yeah, you're right, it's black." You know, once upon a time they thought that the story about the emperor is naked, the emperor has no clothes, was a remarkable story. We do it all the time. We look, only we don't need a reason to fool ourselves, because other people, we really fool ourselves. Not because we want people to think that we're really very fine. We persuade ourselves that night is day and day is night when it suits our purposes. There are really, actually, people who believe that the United States is as dastardly as Russia. There actually are people, I wouldn't be surprised if some in this room, who have persuaded themselves that the American government is as perfidious and as rotten and as untrustworthy as the communists themselves. There are people who persuade themselves that. And facts will never be permitted to disturb them. Never. That's one thing you're not going to catch me with is a pure, ordinary fact. If facts don't suit my decisions, the facts will have to look out for themselves. That's the way we are. It's not the way the other fellow is. It's the way we are. We, all of us. And you need an enormous effort. You need an enormous, determined undertaking to be prepared to pursue the truth, regardless of its consequences. But those who do are going to find it rough to push away what the Jew stands for in his history and in the history of mankind. You're going to find it rough to explain it other than God was there and made a covenant with us. And we entered that covenant and we bound ourselves to that covenant, and that covenant is the meaning and the destiny of the Jew, whatever he believes or thinks or wants. He cannot escape it any longer. That it determines the who he is. It determines the what he is. It determines what will be with him. Will determine where he goes and what happens to him, whether it is to the ovens, whether it is to the land. His destiny as a people with whom this covenant was made is his fate, is his ultimate being. There is no way we can escape it. There is no way we can get out of it. There is no way that we can lose our awareness and consciousness of it. For I say unto you, you all know you're Jewish. What makes you Jewish? What do you share with each other and with all the other Jews around the world? What do you share with them? Do you share with them a history? With the Indian Jew, with the Syrian Jew, the Yemenite Jew, a history, the Ethiopian Jew. You share with him a culture, a language, a race. What do you share with all the other Jews around the world that makes you say, yes, we're all Jewish? Why are we all Jewish? What do we share? A religion? You mean to tell me you think the secular Jew shares the same religion as the Orthodox Jew? And a Reformed Jew shares the same religion as the traditional Jew? You don't know that he is much closer to the Unitarian Christian in theology than he is to the conservative Jew? What do we share? What is it that makes us all Jews other than the covenant? We all have a covenant with God which we cannot escape. That makes us all Jews. What else do we share? What else do we have in common? Not in beliefs, not in practices, not in thinking, not in looks, not in race, not in culture. Nothing! What do we share? What makes us Jews? The covenant. People, we're one. And the only thing that makes us one is a covenant. A covenant that never happened. A covenant that never took place made us one for all the ages, the millennia that have passed, with all the vicissitudes that have taken us to all different places and all different experiences and all different ways of thinking and all different styles of living. A covenant that never happened enabled us to stay together and identify with each other and be one. That's the ultimate impossibility. I'm going to have to buy a covenant that never happened, made us a people, that survived what no other people in the history of mankind have ever even undertaken to live through, but more than live through, to affect and direct and have impact and influence on the whole development of all of mankind to a degree and extent that the largest nations have not been able to do. For this, people of a covenant that doesn't exist, spread, persecuted, driven, have changed the morals and the ethics and the purposes and the direction of all human beings, being as they were less than a tenth of a percent. It is these the people who said to mankind that the noblest of all human beings is not the most efficient killer. Because all the other nations of the earth, north, south, east, west, all the other nations of the world idolize the hero who was the most superb killer of them all. The better killer you are, and use the word killer, use the word warrior. What was a warrior? Not a superb, efficient killer. Who taught them that this was not the ultimate hero of mankind? Was it not the Jew? Who taught them that there was a responsibility that humans owed to other human beings? Was it not the Jew? Who taught them the concepts of justice? Was it not the Jew? This handful of non-covenantal people with a commitment for which they not only lived, but a commitment for which they died rather rigorously. This commitment for something that never happened. Is that the miracle you believe in as more probable than the miracle that God spoke to the people at Sinai? You'd rather accept this incredible miracle? This miracle of uniqueness after uniqueness, that makes sense? That the miracle that God spoke to the people at Sinai, that doesn't make sense? Why not? What militates against it? That we've never experienced it, why should you? If it only happens once. And this itself, the miracle that is the greatest miracle of all, the most intense, the most mighty of all the miracles that have happened in the history of mankind. And let me end with this miracle. This miracle says that when God spoke to the Jews at Mount Sinai, he said to them, "This is the only revelation I make. Once my revelation is complete, the duties and the responsibilities and the obligations are yours. Never again will I interfere. You use this premise, this truth, which I teach you and give you, to take the full responsibility for its development, its application, its use. For never again will I ever send to you a message through a prophet regarding the Torah that I give you. For in giving you a Torah, I give you your freedom and responsibility. I will not inspire your teachers. I will not direct them. You will be responsible for this Torah all by yourself. And each one of you ought to be a learned rabbi. If, God forbid, for some reason you don't make the effort, you'll have to go to one who did. But ideally, you should go to no one. Ideally, each one of you should be a learned rabbi who knows the Torah that I teach and applies it and takes the responsibility for it. For never will I send a prophet with a message about this Torah. That, I submit, is the greatest most incredible miracle of all. It is a miracle that only God can do. All human beings will continue to inspire and to get messages. Only God gives it to men and says, it is now yours. Don't look to me for guidance. I gave you the knowledge. I gave you the premise. I gave you the truth. Use it. It's yours. Use it. The deepest, most amazing, most incredible miracle of war. Live with that one and tell me it wasn't God.
Yeah. There will be no other prophets who tell you.
Lords. There are prophets who tell you futures, but no prophets who will teach you laws. Why do you believe in a prophet? We have many prophets. The only reason we believe in them, by the way, is because the Torah said, I will send you prophets, test them in a particular way. If they follow the test, then listen to what they tell you, provided they don't go against the teachings of the Torah, because if they will say to you that God gave me a new law, reject them. You know that they're liars. Says it. And the Lord said unto Moses, lo, I come unto thee in a thick cloud, that the people may hear when I speak with thee, and may then believe in you forever. Vigam becho yaminu el olam, chapter 19, verse 9. We read next week.
One thing that's always perplexed me about supernatural revelation is that about 40 days later, Moses comes down from Mount Sinai and they're worshiping the golden calf. And if they had the supernatural revelation, I mean, it seems to me that if that happened to me, I would go ahead and worship the golden calf.
Yes, I know. I know. We all think that. We all think that if only a miracle happened now, if God only spoke to me now, then of course everything would be different. If you will give me another 15 minutes, I'm going to tell you two things. Two remarkable, remarkable things. We have, in addition to the Chumash, to the five books of Moses, the Pentateuch as it's called, we have the prophets. One of the prophets is the Book of Kings. And in the Book of Kings, there is a story of a great miracle. Story of the great miracle, which many of you may have had in Hebrew school, of Elijah, Eliyahu HaNavi. Eliyahu HaNavi confronts the servants of the Baal. The Baal is a particular idol worship, which was the idol of Jezebel, Izebel, the wife of Ahab, Ahad, I think they call it in English. And these two were the king and queen absolute of the 10 tribes of Israel, and they imposed the worship of the Baal on the body of the 10 tribes. And during their life and in the life of their son who followed them, the Baal was worshipped within the 10 tribes. Eliyahu confronts the servants of the Baal. And he speaks to all the Jews who are gathered there, and he says, Ad Masay Atam Posim Ashnei Asifim, till when will you straddle the fence? That's where the expression comes from. Oh, Lashem Olabal, come on! Either you follow God, or you follow the worst, but make the stand! So they make his follow. The Baal are going to put up on an altar sacrifices to the Baal. They're going to call on him, Baal, come and take your sacrifice. And then Eliyahu will put on his sacrifices to God, and he'll call on God to take that sacrifice. So they can't get out of that. You know, it's a direct challenge. So that's what they do. Servants of the Baal put the sacrifices on the altar, and they start calling out, and he says to them, louder, louder, he doesn't hear you. It doesn't work. Then Eliyahu comes out and he asks God to take, and a fire comes down from heaven and consumes sacrifices. And all the Jews scream out, Hashem Hu Elokim, God is indeed the Lord. With which we all conclude our Yom Kippur prayer with this cry that took place at Har HaCarmel those many years ago with Eliyahu HaNavi. And the Jews reacted to this miracle immediately and they destroyed the Baal. And Ahav comes home and he says to Jezebel, this is all in there in Kings 2, and he says to Jezebel, Eliyahu did it. And he tells her the story, and Jezebel doesn't get fazed at all. You know what she does? She sends a messenger to Eliyahu, and the message she sends is a very peculiar one. What she says to him is this. Listen to what she says to him. She says to him, tomorrow, I'm going to kill you. That's her message. Tomorrow, I'm going to kill you. Eliyahu gets this message. He goes out to the desert. And he calls on God and says, God, take me. I cannot live anymore. What happened? What did he expect that Jezebel was suddenly going to see the truth and turn back? What did he want? He's been running from her for the last 40 years. She's been trying to catch him and kill him. All of a sudden, he's upset. What did he want out of Jezebel? What do you have to send the message? You're going to kill him. Wait till tomorrow and send the killer to kill him. The answer is very, very straightforward. Jezebel isn't interested in killing him. She says to him, listen, Eliyahu, you got it made, huh? You beat the bar. Wonderful miracle and all the jewels. You're the hero. You're such a hero, I can't kill you. But tomorrow I'll kill you. And nobody will say anything. Your miracle is good for one day. That's how long miracles last. One day. Tomorrow the miracle will be gone. Tomorrow I'll kill you and nobody will make a protest. Today I don't dare. But tomorrow I will. And we all see she's right. That whole thing, I thought I finished. It's gone. My life worked down the drain. God, I can't take it anymore. That's how long miracles last. One day. We've had a miracle that lasted more. I don't know if you remember back at the 67, the exhilaration, the reaching out for a couple of weeks. There was a feeling of something special that God was there again. Reaching out to him, and for a couple of weeks, the whole of Jewry responded to this remarkable, wonderful event. It took 2 weeks. But then, there wasn't such a demand made on us. Miracles don't do it. It's seeking God that does it. Miracles don't do it. Two. Story number two. You have a golden calf in the desert. Let me read to you a story again from the prophets. This time it's Samuel 2. Yerubbaal ben Nebat has been proclaimed the king of the 10 tribes. There is a division in the kingdom of Israel. And Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, is the king of Judah and Benjamin. And Yerubbaal, the son of Nebat, has now become king of the other 10 tribes. And this remains a permanent division until the 10 are taken out and lost. And that's why we're Jews and not Israelites, because we come mainly from the tribe of Judah that survived. That's why we call Jews. We're all there, we'd be Israelites. But because we're almost all from the tribe of Judah, we're called Jews. There are many of us who aren't Jews. The Kohanim and the Levites among us are not Jews. They're Israelites, but they're not Jews. They don't come from Judah. But we call them that anyway. Yerubbaal ben Nebat is afraid. Yerubbaal ben Nebat feels that if the people go back to Jerusalem, to the temple, and worship God, they will leave him and go back to the dynasty of David. And so he sets up two golden calves, the north and the south. And the words he uses are, Eile Elohecha Yisrael Asher Hotziyacha Me'eretz Mitzrayim, word for word, the word that we use on the golden calf in the desert. This is your Lord, O Israel, who took you out of the land of Egypt. Therefore, clearly, he is reconstituting the golden calf of the desert, reestablishing. Now, let's say this is idol worship. So the prophet comes and says to him, there are several sins. One, he changed the holiday of bringing sacrifices from the seventh month, which is Tishrei, the month that we keep Sukkot, he changed it to the eighth month, which is Cheshvan, a month later, because he was afraid if he kept it the same time, they'd go back to Jerusalem and go back to the Davidic dynasty. But the prophet says to him, how could you make a change? If you're worshiping an idol, does it really make a difference which month of the year you're doing it? But then he has another proclamation. You know what else he did? Not only did he make up a new month, but he used to worship non-Kohanim. Miketzosam ha-shalom ibnei Aharon. You mean to tell me there is a law that says that if you want to worship the idols, you have to use a Kohen? You can't use somebody who isn't the Kohen to sacrifice to an idol? The inescapable conclusion is that they're not idols at all. They're not substitutes for God. They are focuses that focus the minds of the people on God. It's hard to worship an unseen God. They used it to focus their mind. But the ones they were worshiping was the ineffable God who took them out of the land of Egypt. They said, as long as we had Moses, our teacher, we had a way of identifying. We had a man whom we saw as being a godly man, and we could live with that. But now that he's gone, how do we concentrate? And so they made the golden calf as a symbol. But it is against the law to have a symbol. Jewish law says no symbol, not just no idol, but no symbol. Remember, he says, Lo ha'isim kol tumuna, don't symbolize God. Don't establish any kind of a symbol. That is the law they violated. It was not idol worship. That's number one. Number two, what greater proof do you have of the truth of the Bible if you seek the truth? What human being would make up a story that 40 days after they heard God, they disobeyed him? How could you tell that? Don't you have the sense of dramatic reality to make it a year later? Unless it happened. That's the point. It happened. And the Torah tells it as it is. And therefore it can happen. And you know something? That's the whole point of everything. God comes to Abraham and says to him, go and sacrifice your son to me. So, what's the great deal? Who wouldn't do it if God himself came and told you to do it? Wouldn't you do it? He says, no, you wouldn't. You think if God speaks to you, you listen? You really think that? God spoke to Bilam and he didn't listen. God spoke to Yeravam and he didn't listen. God spoke to Abraham and he didn't have to listen. He did. That was the magnificence of his faith, the perfection of his love and trust in God, that he didn't believe God would ask of him something that wasn't true and right. That was an act of trust when God himself speaks. Make no mistake, if God spoke to us today, we would argue with him. And when we see the Messiah quickly, may God grant, we'll argue with him. Don't think that truth comes easily, no matter how demonstrated. It's always a struggle. We are free. And when God made man free, he made him free. And he made him free to argue with God. And he made him free to reject God. And he made him free to spurn God himself. Man is free. And therefore responsible. And free from the coercion of God himself. That is what the Torah teaches from the beginning to the end. Adam rejects God. Abraham could reject God. Bilam does reject God. Is it a wonder that the Jews who see him make demands on him? That the Jews who see him say, God, you want too much from us. God, the burden is unbearable. They did it all through the desert, beginning with what we read today and going through till the very end. It's hard to live with God. But it's harder to live without him. It's hard to live with God. But when you do, you've done something really worthwhile. You build, you grow, you make a reality. To build reality does not come by itself or easily. It's a travail. It's a creative act. Creation is never simple. And that's why we Jews have never had an easy faith. It is a faith of participation. We're not given orders by God. We enter a covenant. The meaning of a covenant is two-sided. He obligates himself to us, or we to him. It's a treaty. It's a working together. It isn't do this and this and this. It's working it out. It's like a marriage. It's a husband and a wife who together have to work things out. There's no smooth sailing. It never happens. There are two dealing with each other. When you have two dealing with each other, they're my needs and your needs. They're my recognition of yours, yours recognition of mine. Consideration for each other, working with each other, or arguing with each other. That's our relationship with God. It's a covenant. It is a covenant between two parties. We're free, really free. And that's what freedom means.